Welcome to the dinner party. This is your icebreaker.
Okay, here's a joke. There are two flies up on the ceiling, and one of them says to the other, "Your man is down."
Take a moment to think about it. It's pretty funny.
It's all right.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I am Rico Galliano, and from APM, American Public Media, this is The Dinner Party, the culture show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations.
You just got a joke from Ryan Quincy, creator of the new IFC show Out There.
Nice.
We'll be hearing more from him later. Also, we'll speak with actor Matthew Good, star of the new psychodramatic movie, Stoker.
Plus, musicians Adam Green and Binky Shapiro suggest a dinner party soundtrack. Essayist Michelle Orange doesn't tell us who she looks like. And legendary author, actor, and talk show host Dick Cavett returns to answer your etiquette questions.
We just call him Sensei. Mm. But first, as at any dinner party, we start with small talk.
All week long, you've been hearing these headlines.
The debt ceiling deadline, the fiscal cliff, and the next one is called the sequester.
Pope Benedict XVI is now Pope Emeritus.
And the Oscar goes to Argo.
Now for a story you might not have heard. We are speaking with Pat Morrison. She is a columnist for the LA Times and special correspondent for KPCC in LA. Pat, what story are you going to be talking about at parties this weekend?
I'm going to be telling optimists that they're all going to die.
Whoa.
Why?
That's not very nice.
No, it's not very optimistic of you.
There's a study in the journal Psychology and Aging that says that the more optimistic you are, the likelier it is that bad things are going to happen to you and that you will find yourself falling far short of your expectations.
Oh, my gosh.
Really? So your life will be worse if you're optimistic?
Your life will be worse and shorter.
Well, now I'm confused because as a kind of a pessimist, this gives me cause for optimism.
Yeah, what do we do?
But now what do I do?
It's summed up in a song from one of my favorite Mel Brooks movies, The 12 Chairs, and I'll sing it unless you pay me.
But we won't
pay
you.
What do I have to lose?
Yeah.
Can the day get any worse?
Hope for the best, expect the worst. You could be Tolstoy or Fanny Hurst.
Now you're making me happy, which isn't going to help me.
Yeah, that's right. We're going to die now.
And there's the message. People who were in good health, they had a lot of income, and they were looking forward to an optimistic life, they didn't do so well.
So, I mean, is the reason for that maybe because they think everything's going to be fine so they don't safeguard themselves against bad things happening, like pianos falling from the sky or whatever?
Exactly.
Maybe they're not looking both ways when they step into the street. Maybe they're just too happy to pay attention. They're looking at the bluebirds up in the sky and at the rainbows and the unicorns instead of where they're going.
Guys, I don't think this story is working. I don't think it's going to work. And I'm going to have to live with it longer than any of you.
Yeah.
Because you think it probably will work.
Pat Morrison, thank you so much for the small talk.
Pleasure.
And now, why not have some cocktails? I mean, what does it really matter?
Who cares?
Once again, we tell you something that happened this week in history, then give you a fitting drink to serve along with it.
It's like history is a beach at the edge of an ocean of booze.
I can picture the little umbrella.
Yeah.
First, the history part. This week back in 1878, the world of retail stores changed forever.
The folks at your dinner party probably won't know why. Michelle Philippi tells the tale.
In 1878, a clearance sale changed the retail business. That year, in upstate New York, a guy named Frank Winfield Woolworth was a stock boy in a general store. The owner figured he'd get rid of some extra merchandise by pricing it at a measly 5 cents a pop. It all sold in a flash, and Woolworth got an idea. A store where everything was 5 cents a pop. A few months later, Woolworth debuted his great 5 cent store. It wasn't so great. The place was lit with one lamp. The counters were made of packing crates, and there wasn't much to actually buy, because it turned out the range of stuff you could sell for a nickel was kind of limited. The store barely lasted a few weeks. But that summer, Woolworth tried again in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. This time, he sold items for 5 cents or 10. Now there was plenty of inventory, and people snapped it up. On opening day, he sold 30% of everything in the place. The five and dime store was born. Soon, Woolworths were everywhere, pioneering more than just low prices. Like, instead of asking a guy behind a counter to fetch your merchandise from a storeroom, it all sat out on shelves, and you helped yourself. By 1913, business was so good, Woolworth had a skyscraper built in Manhattan, the world's tallest. He paid for it in cash. Eventually, alas, bigger stores like Target offered more stuff at prices even the original Five and Dime couldn't beat. The last U.S. Woolworths closed in 1997. But the company didn't dissolve, just changed its name and put all its nickels and dimes into a retail shoe chain it had bought along the way. Woolworths is now Foot Locker.
So that was the history lesson. Now it's time for a cocktail to go along with it. On the line, I have Eric Adolfson. He is the proprietor of The Woolly, which is a bar in the Woolworth Building in downtown Manhattan. Eric, tell me a little bit about your bar.
In some ways, we are a kind of bridge between the Woolworth Five and Dime store and the Woolworth Building itself. The Woolworth Building is kind of a fantasy space. It's modeled after a cathedral.
Oh, wow.
But all of the iconography or images you would see in a cathedral, gargoyles, mosaic tiles, all of them have been replaced with things that relate to Frank Woolworth himself and the people around him. So there's gargoyles that represent him counting his money.
Him counting his money? That seems kind of...
Yeah, him counting his money. There's a huge sense of humor. And I think there's this kind of fantastical element where he created this kind of vision of what his empire was about.
Well, let me hear about this cocktail that you've made based on this, the history of Woolworth.
So one of our more kind of go-to cocktails is a variation on a dark and stormy, which we call the dark and woolly.
All right, the dark and woolly sounds interesting. Tell me what's in the drink.
For this conversation, I thought I would maybe make a direct nod to kind of the old five and dime stores, which used to have cafes.
Okay.
So we take brown plastic cups, traditionally found from diners.
Yeah.
Put a shot of Crusian Blackstrap rum.
Okay.
Add whatever cola you want. There's Coca-Cola, there's Pepsi-Cola, Royal Crown.
Okay, cool. I've heard of Coca-Cola. Okay.
And then you can add a dollop of any kind of ice cream. I'm using malted ice cream that comes from Laboratorio del Gelato.
Sounds like an ice cream float with a kick. So that's the dark and woolly. And woolly is what fans of Woolworths used to call it, right? They used to call it woolies.
I think woolly has a much more of a presence in the UK than it does in New York. The word.
Yeah.
We did play off of the woolly, and our actual kind of imagery or icon is a woolly mammoth.
I see. So a nod to another extinct giant.
Yes.
So, Brendan, a monument of Frank Woolworth counting his money.
Yeah.
Somehow, I think if a millionaire put that in a skyscraper today, it wouldn't go over so well.
Yeah, bad form.
Yeah, it's a little tone deaf.
Although I don't think they'd even consider it, because instead of building beautiful buildings these days, they just build rectangles.
That's true.
Functional.
But a nice check on their egos. It's good.
True.
All right, folks, you can find the recipes for some very ornate drinks at our website. It is dinnerpartydownload.org.
And now, the guest list, in which an interesting person lists some interesting things.
And today, our guest is Ryan Quincy. For over a decade, he was an animator on the TV series South Park. He launched his own animated show just this last week. Here he is to tell us about it and the list it inspired.
Hi, this is Ryan Quincy. I'm the creator of Out There, a show on IFC. Out There is a comedy, probably more seen as a dramedy, about two best friends that are 15. One of them, Chad, is this introverted wallflower of a kid, and then Chris, the wild child, and the whole storyline is about all their adventures through adolescence. Yes, the show is semi-autobiographical. Absolutely. Here are my three coming-of-age stories that capture the teen years and that angst and agony and ecstasy really well. The first one would be The Adventures of Pete and Pete, a show in the 90s on Nickelodeon, and it sent around two brothers, both named Pete. It was an amazing, unprecedented show at the time, set in this surreal suburb, a cross between, you know, Leave It to Beaver and The Twilight Zone. But it was genuine and touching without being too precious. And my favorite episode is about little Pete having to say goodbye to Artie, the strongest man in the world, who is his best friend, superhero, Boo Radley, guardian angel type guy.
Out there is some boy who need me. He's small. He's puny. Like he were.
But Artie, you're my best friend.
I think it just resonates with adolescence and like having to say goodbye to childhood things like comic books and firecrackers and tree houses and beautiful childhood stuff, and then having to go off and become a boring adult.
You know, son, I'm gonna miss that mutant.
Number two on the list is probably the antithesis of Pete and Pete, 1979's cult classic Over the Edge. It's the quintessential ultimate teenage rebellion epic. It's about kids stuck in the suburbs, these restless youths and disaffected teens who feel estranged from their remote parents and teachers, and it was extremely influential, and it was Matt Dillon's first movie, by the way.
Okay, listen, make it to Sweetwater, stash the car, then we can sell the gun, then we can move out, Jack, anywhere. My mother won't rat. She won't tell the pigs. Pigs won't find out.
We're running away?
Bye-bye, new granola.
Bye.
I watched that so much as a kid on HBO. Over the Edge was a huge influence on Out There also, because Carl, the good kid, becomes friends with Richie, Matt Dillon character, this miscreant, very similar to the dynamic of Chad and Chris in Out There. And that was something that always stuck with me. I was like, I want to make an animated Over the Edge. And then continuing, I guess, on this existential angsty route, number three would be the music of Jimmy Lee Lindsay Jr., also known as Jay Retard. Jay Retard was this wonder boy, prolific musician who started in the slums of Memphis. He was 14, 15. He just got an 8-track and recorded all the instruments himself. You know, he died when he was 29, but his volume of work is just expansive and amazing. And it's so, you hear this raw rage, this unbridled, cathartic, you know, yelling at the heavens and in hell. And it's just, I think it's a perfect soundtrack for teenagers everywhere. The first song that I heard was called Trap There. And when I was working on Out There, I would just listen to that song over and over, repeat. When I look at it on my iTunes, on my counter, it's like 376 or something. I listened to that song so much because that put me in this whole world where these characters lived and Out There.
Guest list from Ryan Quincy. You can catch his new animated series Out There Friday nights on IFC.
And you know, instead of a coming-of-age cartoon, I want to see an arrived-at-age cartoon, you know?
What would that be?
Where the characters are numb and they're on hold with the gas company about a bill.
Yeah, that's uplifting. I'd tune in for that.
I like realism.
Folks, coming up, TV legend Dick Cavett imitates Hitchcock.
The most promiscuous woman I've ever known.
Find out who Cavett / Hitch is talking about when the dinner party continues.
Welcome back to The Dinner Party, the culture show that helps you win your dinner party. I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan. Coming up, we learn the history of the circus, and we learn why essayist Michelle Orange has had it with this question.
Who do you remind me of?
But first up, we'd like it if our next guest reminded people of us.
Yes.
That'd be great.
Please, each week you send us your questions about etiquette, and here to answer them this time around is Dick Cavett. On his own The Dick Cavett Show, his interviews with celebrities ranging from Groucho Marx to John Lennon were renowned for their humor and intelligence. He's also a regular columnist for The New York Times. And Dick, welcome.
Thank you. Did you happen to pick Marx and Lennon by accident?
It was, we assure you, just a mistake.
It was subconscious.
That's very clever.
Wow. That's what, there's people listening to public radio who are thinking the same thing.
Perfect for this audience. Either way.
They kind of look the same with the glasses. So this isn't your first time on the radio, though, Dick. In addition to being on our show once before, I read that in eighth grade, you hosted a live Saturday morning radio show.
Oh, you.
Is that true?
Storytime Playhouse, and Over the Rainbow was the theme, somewhere, and I cast myself playing the witch, the sea captain, and let's say the hunchback, in a 15-minute adaptation of a Dickens novel or something.
Wow. So this was a local show for students?
Local show. The Junior League of New York sent the scripts actually out from New York City.
Wow. And you were in Nebraska?
And I was in Nebraska, knew I'd probably never get out of there, but someday I hope by God I would get to New York City. Mm.
And it worked out.
Did you wear little suits? I'm picturing you.
Smoking cigarettes?
Yeah.
No, I think I wore a T-shirt and jeans.
Wow.
But already you were the point person to kind of be the master of ceremonies.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how I got that. I started off as an actor on it, and then they said, I got so sick as a kid of hearing, where did a little fellow like you get such a big voice?
Wow.
They actually went, and sometimes they said a little thing like you. Once showing the wit that would someday distinguish me, I said to an old sod who said that in the library, I said, where did a big voice like you get such a little thing?
They were like, give that kid a show.
Yeah.
Amazing. Well, look, you went on to interview, you know, some of the biggest stars of many decades.
By the way, anytime you want to hear me do some of the guests I've had on, there's an audiobook of my book Talk Show out, and people said they love it because every time I mention somebody, I do their voice.
Nice.
You're tempting us here.
Want to hear Hitchcock?
Sure.
He said this to me during a commercial break. Grace Kelly, the most promiscuous woman I've ever known.
Oh, my goodness.
Cue the music.
I want you kind of to answer all of our listeners' questions as Alfred Hitchcock.
Well, it makes your voice hoarse. Otherwise, I would.
Okay. All right.
The way to do it is put the tip of your tongue on your back upper left tooth and talk.
Okay.
Right. Like you're trying to get something out of your tooth.
Well,
you're right.
I have a question here from Jamie.
Now cut that out.
Via Facebook.
Are we going to have to do these horrible questions?
Yes, sorry.
They're not horrible, we promise. Jamie, via Facebook, she asks, what is the most polite way to tell your boss that the guy in the cubicle next to me always uses his speakerphone? It's really very distracting. Oh, and the guy is his nephew, the boss's nephew.
Oh, that is tough because that would drive you absolutely up the cheap cubicle wall.
Yes.
I think.
It's only half a wall, though.
Yeah, you can see the bugger if you look up over there. I guess I would probably say to the boss as genteelly as I could, your nephew, is it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Is such a polite fellow that he allows me to hear all his phone conversations, both sides of them.
Hmm.
I guess I'm lucky. It's entertaining. It's better than getting my work done, you could say.
It's lowering my productivity, which makes me feel mellow. That's great.
Yeah, that's good, too. So I wouldn't want anything much to change.
Yeah, yes. And I just thought I'd tell you that. I feel like I'm part of your family now, boss.
A little reverse psychology is what you're saying.
You took the word out of my mouth.
All right.
All right, well, there you go, Jamie.
Do we have to do any more questions?
Yeah, sorry.
All right, here's JR in Los Angeles. JR writes, is it okay to leave during a live theatrical performance you are not enjoying? I feel, says JR, like it is a total slap in the face to the actors or the orchestra and other real live people that you're watching versus, say, a film where you're not sharing their presence. Mm-hmm. But I'm a non-confrontational person, on the other hand. To leave or not to leave?
I think it is awful for the actors who are probably doing their best.
Probably.
But then you and the audience are doing your best, too, and you don't deserve to be bored stiff.
Yeah. And can they see you? I mean, it's dark. You are an actor.
I would die rather than drop a name, but I went to a play
of course.
This past year. James Gandolfini was in it.
Yes.
Went back to see him afterwards, and he said, I saw you all through the first act. I was sitting in the front row, and the lights spill, as we call it in the theater. I was as well lighted as Gandolfini and the other actors were.
Also starring Dick Cavett.
Yeah.
People got an extra.
So that's a good strategy for JR, maybe, to get a seat in the back where it's dark.
Sit near the back or sit with a friend and start talking to the friend in full voice, chattering about things like, is John McCain getting even weirder? And, you know, Cardinal Mahoney certainly won't be the next pope, to annoy people around you. And then.
Oh, I like this. You get kicked out.
Yes.
Yeah, then it's not on your head, so to speak.
Oh, right.
So wait a minute. The polite thing to do is to talk loudly about weird things.
Yeah.
And get thrown out in that way.
And so you don't have to feel guilty in one bit. Miss Hepburn, Catherine Hepburn. Stratford, Connecticut, summer of 57, Merchant of Venice. She's starring as Portia. I'm an extra on stage.
Whoa.
Wow.
She made her entrance sliding down from upstage on a piece of scenery in a beautiful costume. And as she opened her mouth to speak, "Ah, Nerissa, my little body is aweary of it," bang, a flashbulb.
From the audience?
Yeah.
And?
Miss Hepburn stopped, raised her right hand, and said, "We'll pause now." And looking at an individual in the fifth row, while one selfish woman gets all the god pictures she wants.
Oh, man.
So, I promise you, it was more dramatic than anything in the play.
Yeah.
So, JR, talk annoyingly and get thrown out, but do not take a photograph, whatever you do.
Yeah.
Dick Cavett, that's all the time we have. Thank you for telling our audience how to behave.
When do we go on the air?
Dinner party favorite Dick Cavett.
Hooray.
As you can tell, he really does hate name dropping, but we love it when he does.
Yes, which is always. Folks, if you have questions about how to behave or how to impersonate people, send them to us and we will share them with someone nominally qualified to answer them.
Or if you simply want to hear your name and the name of the town you're from on the radio, contact us at dinnerpartydownload.org and tell us what your problem is.
You can also call the DPD hotline, aka the phone at Brendan's cubicle. The number is 213-621-3554. That is 213-621-3554.
And now, time to eavesdrop.
Michelle Orange's articles and fiction have appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, and McSweeney's. Today we overhear her reading from her latest collection.
Hello, my name's Michelle Orange. I have a new book out. It's called This is Running for Your Life, and it's an essay collection. And I'm going to read a little bit from one of the essays called Do I Know You? And Other Impossible Questions. So I seem to have one of those faces. It's the kind of face people think they know. Perhaps this isn't uncommon at all. In fact, the majority of participants in a recent polling on the matter affirmed that, yeah, they get that all the time. On some level, and to some degree, we all somehow suspect we've encountered one another before. So I, like you apparently, get this a lot. And there was a point, 2 years ago, when I lost my patience. It happened as I was speaking with two gentlemen at an exceptionally civilized housewarming thrown by a lovely couple who happened to be my sole acquaintances in the room. As we talked about the space, which was grand, and the host's Florentine wedding, which was grandissimo, one of the gentlemen, a money guy, got a foggy look in his eyes. I know that look. It's a prelude to one of my least favorite questions, which comes in several variations. Who do you look like? Where have I seen you before? Who do you remind me of? Do I know you? She reminds me of someone, he said. Who is it? I told him I hated this game and that it never ended well. But soon, three others were pointing their noses in, close to mine, and shouting celebrity names like Pictionary clues. I followed what I'm pretty sure is the advised strategy in a bear attack. Keep still, don't make eye contact, and wait for it to be over. Eventually, he left the room to seek out a computer and Google his mind to rest. He gathered a team around the monitor in the study, where they deliberated over the actress he had in mind. No one noticed when I pulled my coat from the closet behind them and walked out the door. This bothered me for a long time. I complained bitterly about it to my dad, who seemed to have one of those faces as well. All while growing up, I was advised of my father's resemblances, variations on the dark and handsome theme, by friends and strangers alike. He just looked like my dad to me. But then it happened. I was around 13 when I saw The Philadelphia Story, my first Jimmy Stewart movie.
Tracy.
What do you want?
You're wonderful.
Dad, I said. That's you. He smiled and said I was batty. A pretty Jimmy Stewart response when you think about it. But I was adamant. It became important for him to recognize what I saw plainly for myself. How could he not? Hadn't people told him? I have a better understanding of his befuddlement now. Though I'll be damned if I'm wrong about Jimmy Stewart. It still happens. Last year, my dad and I were piling up an A&P conveyor belt with Christmas booty when he caught the checkout lady's eye. You know, you look like someone, she observed from behind the register. You look like that actor. Abe Vigoda, I offered. She looked at me as though I'd just jammed a stick into a 10-speed's whirling front wheel. When it comes to strangers and strange people at parties, I've made peace with what I call the compare and conquer. The impulse we have when confronted with something perfectly ordinary and frankly terrifying, a new human being, to solve them somehow, contain them in some satisfying way, and avoid looking further into yet another wild abyss. Soon after that night, I made a trip to my local library. I noticed the security guard starting to laugh when she saw me coming. As I moved closer, opening up my bag for inspection, she waved me away and asked if I'd forgotten something. She thought she knew me. She thought she'd just seen me. I winked at her and slipped inside.
Essayist Michelle Orange reading from her new collection called This Is Running for Your Life. And you are listening to The Dinner Party from American Public Media. And yes, we know we look like George Clooney.
And Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, we get it all the time.
It's time for Chattering Class. This is the part of the show where we talk to an expert about a dinner party-worthy topic. Today, our subject is the circus, and our expert is Duncan Wall. He is a teacher at the National Circus School of Montreal, as well as a performer and a writer. He has a new book out this week called The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. So, Duncan, your book is primarily a history of the circus, but in it, you also talk about your relationship to the art form. So tell me, were your parents sad when you ran off to join the circus?
They weren't entirely surprised, because I think it sort of fit in their conception of me as a person.
Okay.
They totally didn't understand what the kind of circus that I was running off to was. Mm. Like, for them, the circus was very much something traditional, American, North American, Ringling Brothers style.
Yeah.
We sat down and watched a Cirque du Soleil video, I remember, to sort of coach them through it, and that helped. But I will say that there was a moment when I was getting on the airplane, and my father, who's a sort of staid Midwestern man, had never, I'd seen him cry once before, and then he cried at the airport
putting
it in the plane. Because I think the circus for him was just something so exotic and romantic and extreme that it was hard for him to conceptualize, like, where my life would be going after that.
You know? But were they tears of excitement, or were they tears of, oh my God, we raised him and now we're losing him to this crazy lifestyle?
Yeah, I think they were abject fear. I think he was totally, totally afraid that I would become a gypsy with a ponytail down to my...
So in your book, you talk about the man who is mostly responsible for the breadth of the modern circus. His name is Philip Astley. Tell us about him and his role in the development of the circus.
Philip Astley was a British cavalier who, in the 18th century, came to England and saw that there was a developing genre of what was called equestrian theater.
Okay.
So it was basically guys who had been in the war, got out of the war, needed to make some dough, and so started performing in London the skills that they had learned in the war.
Huh.
So, like, if you dropped your gun on the battlefield, you might slip off the side of your horse and pick it up while you're riding. He decided that was more interesting than the army. He quit the army. He came to London. He created his first show, his equestrian show, in 1768. And basically it was, him performing various stunts, his wife performing various stunts. At first there was no other acts. It was just him doing cool stuff on horses in a field with a little kind of ring around it. 2 years later, he started bringing in acts from the fairgrounds. So he brought in, wire walkers, animal acts, jugglers, and in so doing created kind of our conception of the form.
So you're talking about the stereotype of the circus, like Barnum and Bailey here in the States.
Yeah, when we think of like the kind of, our popular cultural conception of the circus, the traditional circus, right? The ring, the ringmaster, the red and yellow, like those all come from Philip Astley. Like the red and yellow of the circus was actually from the red and gold of the British cavalry. So like the red coats are coming. The ring that Astley defined was 13 meters in diameter. And that form basically stayed the form of the ring, the shape of the ring for almost 200 years until the big revolution that happened in the late 60s and early 70s, which is a lot of what the book is about.
So let's talk about that revolution. One of the themes of your book is, the difference between the old circus, the popular conception of the circus, which is the guy with the top hat, et cetera, and kind of the new circus. The Cirque du Soleil is part of that contemporary circus movement. When did the modern circus emerge and how did it come about?
Yeah, so basically as part of the whole popular movements of the 60s, performers largely from the theater became interested in popular art forms like mime, like puppetry, like the circus, and started incorporating those techniques into their work. Until that point, there were no circus schools in the world. Most circus skills were taught, passed down through families. It was father to son, mother to daughter. At that point, the theater companies began incorporating the skills. At the same time, a few circus families, or particularly young members of circus families, decided that they want to spread the skills outside the families. So they started opening schools. And from there, it just sort of began exploding. And what you saw was the development of a new form of circus.
When you show up at a contemporary show, what is different between that and when people think about the guy with the top hat and the whip and the lion and the chair?
When you see a contemporary circus, you see there are often no animals.
Okay.
There's often a kind of theatrical flair. So there are characters that you follow. There's a different sense of dramaturgy, right? So there's actually a kind of like, there's more attention paid to the lights and the sound. Basically, the shows are created like dance works or like theater works instead of, which is the cobbling together, being cobbled together, which is the way they used to create circuses.
Is your dad happy now?
It's funny. My mom came up and we saw a show from No-Fit State Circus, which is a circus from Wales. And it's a bit like De La Guarda, which played in New York. Like you're on the floor, they're moving you around. There's people kind of violently charging into each other. And she was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. This is fantastic. Like, it's so invigorating, right? And she went home and told my dad. And he was like, yeah. his response, and the irony about my father actually is his response to everything I do artistically is always like, he thinks of himself as this regular Midwestern guy, right? So it's sort of like, oh, that's interesting, but it's a little bit above me. Well, I don't get that, Kev. That's too, whereas with the circus, he can't do that, right? Because it's like this popular art form. So sure. I'm still sort of waiting for the day when I can take my father to a contemporary circus show and have him have the moment that I know he'll have, which is like, whoa, this is crazy. This is really great.
And then your poor mother, because so you may run off and join the circus too.
Yeah, and then she's screwed.
Enrico, another reason for his dad not to worry.
All right.
Duncan says Cirque du Soleil makes almost $1 billion a year.
What?
Yes, there's money in the circus.
Which explains why there are no sad clowns in Cirque du Soleil, I guess.
Right, yes. If you're a sad clown, you are a clown.
Agreed.
Yeah.
All right, folks. Coming up, we get some song suggestions from musical duo Adam Green and Binky Shapiro. The star of the new movie Stoker talks about being a creepy uncle and a devoted dad. And I learn all about dining tiki style.
Chicken livers wrapped with bacon. Health food.
And I chase it with a drink named after an explosive when the dinner party continues. Welcome back to The Dinner Party, the show that gives you an edge in your weekend conversations. I'm Rico Galliano.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan. In a few minutes, actor Matthew Good talks about playing someone bad.
There's a stretch.
Sure is.
Crazy.
But first, it's time for the main course, where we talk about the best part of any dinner party, the food.
And Brendan, this month, the Los Angeles area will say goodbye to an institution.
Smog, that's amazing.
I wish that were true. No, it is bahuka.
Wait, isn't that the Hawaiian word for smog?
It is not. But it is one of the coolest surviving examples of mid-century South Pacific-themed tiki-style restaurants.
Ah.
Yes, the restaurant has existed in various locations since 1967, and now it's closing. So I headed over there to pay my last respects, along with Sven Kirsten. He authored the Book of Tiki, which is sort of the Bible on the subject. And I started by asking him to describe bahuka for listeners who, alas, can't see it for themselves.
It's certainly amazing. I mean, and it's very unique in its style because it's so cavernous. And if you want to get more specific, I would call it more of a beachcomber style restaurant than tiki. It's just built with all this jetsam and flotsam of the seven seas. The ceiling alone is just like unbelievably crowded with all these barrels and fishnet floats and found objects.
And you're missing the biggest part. We're surrounded by aquariums that have like every variety of fish known to man inside of them.
Right. If you pan down from the ceiling, you get to the aquariums that are lining every booth. There's like, 99 aquariums in this place. Yeah, you feel like you're underwater here in these booths.
God, I mean, I love also the tables have this kind of nautical chain attaching the tabletop to the ceiling. I'm sure that that's not necessary structurally, but it sure looks cool.
It's, again, part of the look, the anchor chain. You know, you walk outside of this restaurant and they have a anti-aircraft gun from a destroyer and lifeboats, and it's incredible.
Let's go back a ways. When was the kind of great wave of tiki restaurants? When did they sort of start springing up?
The great wave happened in the late 50s and early 60s. All centered around Hawaii becoming a state. When Hawaii became part of America, a lot of developers thought to jump in on this trend and not only build a restaurant, more restaurants and bars than there already were, into apartment buildings, bowling alleys, motels, and became an actual style.
The restaurants existed first and the bars sort of before the 60s, and then in the 60s it became the style that went into everything.
And eventually, come on in.
Hi, we're going to order. Oh my gosh,
yes.
Look what has just been brought down. What is this?
A grenade with a pin pulled? Yes, that's the name of the, it's like a house cocktail here.
So really? This cocktail is called the grenade with a pin pulled?
Yes.
That's a pretty morbid name.
Well, it has 151 rum in it, so it's pretty deadly.
See? Let's talk about the tiki cocktail. I mean, this is a classic. There's, of course, an umbrella in it. There's a toothpick with a wedge of pineapple and a maraschino cherry. Very festive looking. There's like a whole lot of... This is why, as a young child, you know, that was my idea of what cocktails must be, is just like these fun explosions of toys, basically. Where did this come from, this style of cocktail?
It all started out with Don the Beachcomber. He opened his bar in Hollywood in 1934.
Don the Beachcomber?
Yeah, his real name was Ernest Beaumont Gant, but he decided to cast himself as a character from the South Seas. And he was so successful that eventually he was just known as Don the Beachcomber. And he even legally renamed him, had himself, you know, registered as Don Beach. I guess Don the Beachcomber wasn't legal as a name, so he became Don Beach, and he was like the great ambassador of Polynesian pop there.
And he came up with these kind of like frilly looking drinks?
Yeah, he had a real sense of flourish in terms of not only the mixing, but also of the presentation of these drinks. Presented them and carved out pineapples in all kinds of glasses. There's even an anecdote from Heather Harper.
The great gossip columnist, right?
Yeah, the great, you know, Hollywood gossip columnist. Don the Beachcomber had celebrity clientele, and among them were the Marx brothers. Groucho Marx was friends with Salvador Dali. He invited Dali to dine with him as Don the Beachcomber, and the drinks came. Dali was convinced that they were like specially designed for him because they looked so surreal. I love that story.
They should have put a melting watch over the edge of the glass. It would have been a Dali Beachcomber drink.
The big draw for these places, it wasn't really the food, it was the cocktails, and that's where they made their money too.
That is certainly the deal here too. I think most people will say that they come here for the atmosphere and the drinks and not so much the food. But there is standard food at, you know, tiki places. Where does that come from? Does it actually have anything to do with Polynesian cuisine?
It's more what it was for Don the Beachcomber, and from there on for the rest of the places, it was Chinese food. The only exotic cuisine that existed in America at the time in the 1930s, Chinese food with a little bit of, you know, inventiveness. You know, they added pineapple to everything, you know, and that was new to the American palate back then.
The pineapple?
Yes, the sweet and sour kind of aspect. And, you know, for example, for this appetizer that Don the Beach invented, chicken livers were cheap in the 30s. Chicken livers wrapped with bacon, health food. He came up with the name Rumaki by opening a page in a Cook Islands dictionary and, you know, pointing the finger down, and it landed on Rumaki, which is some kind of bird. It was all made up.
He took cheap chicken livers, wrapped them in bacon, picked a sort of Asian-sounding name, and bingo.
Yeah, it was Polynesian food.
And Brendan, one more cocktail fact that Sven told me.
Okay.
At one point, there was so much competition between tiki bartenders that Don the Beachcomber actually took the labels off the bottles in his bar and labeled them with a secret code.
Whoa.
So the competition couldn't figure out the recipes.
Wow.
I love it.
So the grenade with the pin pulled, you know, might have actually had gunpowder in it. We don't know.
That's, yeah. Or more likely, right? Grenade Dean.
Shaking head disapprovingly.
I see that. Thank you.
Our guest of honor this week is actor Matthew Good. He has starred in several films, including A Single Man, Chasing Liberty, and Woody Allen's London-based thriller Match Point. He's in a new film, which comes out this week, the dark psychological thriller Stoker. In it, he plays mysterious Uncle Charlie, a long-lost member of the Stoker family, who returns home after his brother's death. Matthew, first of all, are you an uncle in real life?
I am, actually. I am an uncle to my sister's daughter. So I have a niece, and my brother is actually about to have, well, not himself, obviously, his other half is about to have a child.
Does that add to the creep factor in playing a character like this?
I mean, I try not to think about it or compare, you know, there's not a lot of emotional memory of mine own, you know, wrapped up and invested in Charlie in that way. But it was funny because I had my daughter with me when we were filming in Nashville, and she was there a little bit, but she was also there when we were watching the scene of young Uncle Charlie in the sandpit, you know, so that was quite disturbing.
That is disturbing. How old is your daughter?
I felt very protective. At that point, she was like two, so she's now, she's going to be four in a couple of days.
That is a little creepy. But I wonder, as an actor, do you ever have any hesitation playing a part that could maybe color future audiences' perceptions of you?
You know, you do worry about getting typecast. I mean, I don't worry terribly, but there have been some projects that I haven't gone towards because I've been worried that the impact would lead me to be seen in such a way. It would be like if, you know, equivalent of if you took Christian Grey, for example. There's a possibility that's what you become known for.
Do you remember the moment you decided to be an actor?
I wasn't like 5 years old, like some people are like that. I knew then I was going to do this all my life. It wasn't that how it was for me. I mean, it was always a case of putting off entering the real world for as long as I could. I mean, I loved it. I loved it, and I thought that I, you know, could possibly do it, which is why I sort of stuck around. So I went to university, and then I finished, you know, when I was finishing university, a friend of mine who, if I'm honest, didn't think was the world's greatest actor. And he got into drama school, so I was like, bloody hell, if Gary's in, I might as well have a crack at it. And that's really unfair on him. He is good. So then went to drama school, and then I just came out. I luckily finished with, you know, got picked up by a very, very good agent who's still my agent today.
But it was all part of a larger strategy to avoid the real world, and it's working for you, so I applaud you for that.
Thank you. Yeah, there was never really a plan B.
Well, this is kind of a unique film in many ways, and one of the ways it's unique is it's directed by Park Chan-wook, who is one of the most popular and acclaimed directors in his native Korea. This is his first English language film. And I read that on the set, he communicated with you and the other actors through a translator.
Yes.
How did that work, and was it odd?
When I first spoke to him on Skype for about an hour, and the only thing that was odd was, who do I look, even it's 7,000 miles away and I'm just on a computer screen, you're like, who do I look at when, you know.
Oh, wow. So you spoke to him and his translator on Skype.
Yeah, of course. And so, yeah. But actually, when we got onto set, he speaks more, he understands a lot more English than he can necessarily speak sometimes. Although when you get a couple of drinks down him, you know, he's much more, like we all are, we're much less shy about it, and you don't worry about making the mistakes. So, but for convenience and time, he has a fantastic translator called Wonjo Jong, who has the ability to just be able to sort of speak and listen at the same time. It's kind of a feat, and he works very quickly. And we also kind of worked out our own shorthand, and so after a couple of days, it was pretty set and it was fairly seamless.
This film, like many of, I guess you call him Director Park, correct?
We do, it's not a formality. I think it's just that's how he's addressed at home in his native land. And so that was something that was picked up on, I think, by everyone else in the production. And so when I got to set, it's like, oh, Director Park would like to speak to you. And I was like, wow, it's quite formal, but I quite like that.
We'll call him Director Park then.
Yes, if you wouldn't mind.
So actor Matthew, you once said in an interview, I'd like to think I'm a director's actor. I think you were talking about your performance in A Single Man directed by Tom Ford. What did you mean by that?
I just mean as in it's, you know, film is a director's medium. And I think you have to really trust your director and believe in them and think that they know best. And sometimes they make a decision on something and you kind of go, I don't know if that's going to work. And very, very rarely have I ever been right when I've thought I was. But yeah, I mean, it's his vision. I'm here to help make that come to fruition.
Well, it's early in your career. You'll have plenty of time to go crazy later on and be mean to people.
Plenty of time to fall out and go mental. Okay, good.
That's what we're looking for. All right. Well, look, we have two standard questions on our show that we ask each of our guests.
Okay.
And the first question is, what question are you tired of being asked in interviews?
Oh, God, I don't think I have one, actually. No, nothing comes up. I've always been quite lucky then, therefore, and there's nothing like that's, yeah.
You're just a pretty amiable chap. You're willing to answer. I see you talk to a British person, use words like chap. I just did that.
You did. Chap or fella. Nothing ever sort of comes up that I can think of. You know, it's not like I've had a Hugh Grant episode where it's like, so that thing that happened on Sunset, that would probably be quite annoying after all. So no episode like that's happened to me yet, and may it never.
Well, I'll take that. So our second question is, tell us something we don't know, and this can be a fact about you and your life, or it could be just kind of an interesting fact about the world, kind of like a something that would impress folks at a dinner party.
Well, I suppose a fact. What's a fact about me? My wife is pregnant, or my wife-to-be is pregnant again. How about that?
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
And you have a daughter you mentioned earlier, right?
I do, yeah. I have my daughter, Matilda, who's going to be 4 in a couple of days, growing up fast.
Having had your daughter, has that affected how you've, like, the roles you've selected or kind of your kind of acting
career? No, not yet. No, I mean, I haven't got to that position where I'm like, I must make a film that she can see. It'd be really nice, but, you know, as I say, I'm a pretty jobbing actor. It's not like I pick and choose, so.
But, and you're obviously, you'll take her to any type of set imaginable because you took her to Stoker, so. So there's no problem there.
Yeah, but I wouldn't have subjected her. You know, I think, you know, you take her when you know that there's not going to be something there that might scar her for life. Oh, this is the day that I'm strangling someone in the woods. Hey, Moo, how's it going?
So if you get to take a role in Saw 6, you might not bring her along.
That's never going to happen.
So, Brendan, yeah, I can imagine watching Dad play a creepy uncle might lead to some big future psychiatry bills.
Yeah, but maybe not seeing Dad at all because he left you at home while he went off to play the creepy uncle would be equally damaging.
That's true. So basically, don't be an actor and handcuff your kid to your wrist.
That's good parenting.
I agree. All right, ladies and gentlemen. We've had drinks, met our guest of honor. One thing remains for a perfect dinner party, some music to play.
For that, we turn to Adam Green of anti-folk band The Moldy Peaches and Binky Shapiro, singer for the band Little Joy. They just released a self-titled album. Here they are with some song suggestions.
Cheers. This is Adam Green.
And Binky Shapiro. For our dinner party soundtrack, we've put together some songs that we hope you enjoy as much as we do.
Our first song is Sistina's by Glenn Danzig, and it's a kind of Elvis-like, operatic, crooning ballad.
Take my hand, you'll never find another white light.
The singer says she's got a Sistine smile, and I don't know what that means, like Sistine smile.
Sistine smile.
I think it's something very gothic to say. I'm attracted to that aesthetic. Binky is a little bit of a goth, which I think is what draws me to her.
Hey, the sun don't shine, the wind won't blow when you go high.
I like how Danzig is sort of like, he's like Dean Martin or like the Righteous Brothers, but he's got a metal band. I want to be like that. I wanted to have a metal band. Too. Binky Shapiro is stopping me from making a metal album. And she knows it. And you can see the look all over her face.
The second song on our playlist is by the OCs. And the song is called If I Stay Too Long. They're a pretty wild band. Like, they're just that band that you see playing live, and you know that everybody that's watching them is thinking, I wish I was in this band. This is like that moment where everybody's talking and you just like sit back and like your mind gets quiet for a second and you realize that you actually do have a pretty okay life. All right, the last song on our playlist. Oh, a fitting title, perhaps. Although it doesn't really have anything to do with what the song's about, but it is a song by Jarvis Cocker.
It's called Leftovers, off of his album, Further Complications.
I met her in the Museum of Paleontology. And I make no bones about about it. I said, if you wish to study dinosaurs, I know a specimen whose interest is undoubted.
A brilliantly written song. There's a lot of humor and a very unique delivery style that I've fallen for many a time.
Told you three times.
You feel what he's saying.
And at the risk of repeating myself, I'm gonna say it again.
Finally, the song of our own that we would play at our dinner party is Just to Make Me Feel Good. At the end of the dinner party, we would tell everybody, we're going to get divorced, and...
this is why.
This is why. Yeah, enjoy your dessert.
Nosh on this.
Don't assume I'm just boring, but mourning a love that's not forming.
She used to stray like a bull in my maze. Just to make me feel good.
Someone who really knows you offers no mystery to slave through.
A dinner party soundtrack from Adam Green and Binky Shapiro. They are on tour in support of their new self-titled album. And that is the dinner party for this week.
Tune in next week when we'll speak to actor Laura Dern. Till then, our assistant producer is Jackson Musker. Tamika Adams is our intern. Peter Clowney is our executive producer. And thanks to Bill Lance.
Bon appétit.